Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is Monday, March 2nd. I'll turn the volume up just maybe a little bit like that. Fantastic. Here's a sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign sign-in sheets. I'll pass it around. Thank you. I'll turn some of these lights down. Then we're going to take a look at the schedule. And I think this is all looking good. So schedule's on the right-hand side. Today is the 2nd, so we're all the way down over here. We're going to talk about joints. That's chapter 9. And so you're done with your first lecture exam, your first practicum, and the Monday morning lab has seen all their tests. We've got everything graded. Everything's in Blackboard. You'll be able to check everything out. And so we're doing good. So when is your next test? It's going to be on a Monday. And that's March 16th. Ooh, so it's going to be coming up pretty soon. It's in 2 weeks, exactly 2 weeks from today. So it's a Monday. Here are the chapters, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And what are we going to do today? We're going to do 9. So after today, just 2 more chapters. Oh, that's going to include some muscles, 10 and 11, all the muscles. Then we get into nervous system. All right, so does anybody have a question about the schedule? Your next practicum is not until the week after the next lecture exam, starting on Monday, of course. That will be your second practicum. So in lab, we'll look at that schedule in particular. All right, so does anybody have any questions at all? Questions about what we've covered so far? I think I have all the lectures uploaded into Blackboard. And the other thing that is approaching is spring break. All right, that's coming pretty quickly. All right, so let's get into joints a little bit, unless we have some questions about what we're doing in here. All right, so I promised that in this chapter we're going to start to learn a little bit about some physiology, right? And so what is physiology determined by? Okay, physiology is the study of function, but my interest is to know what determines the function of something. Yeah, the shape, right? So we're going to look at the shapes of different kinds of joints in our body, and that's going to tell us what kind of function that joint is, right? So here's a nice introduction to physiology, and it's going to relate very, very nicely to anatomy because we're going to look at some structures. Yeah. Oh, we got to go back and finish 8? Nice. Let's go back and finish 8. Okay. I don't remember, but I think we should be able to find it pretty fast. Okay, 8, 8, 8, 8. What did we still have to do in 8? The whole lower limb? Yeah, okay. All right, well, fortunately, the lower limb follows the design of the upper limb. And sometimes it's not even as complicated as the upper limb because we don't have an elbow. Right, we can't pronate and supinate our hand. And, okay, so how about ascoxae? Did I talk about ascoxae at all? Yeah, I think I got through that. All right, the ascoxae and the scapula and clavicle make something special in our bodies. What do those bones make? Just a general name. I heard it. Somebody said it. Not too loud, but I heard it. They make girdles. That's right, they make girdles. So the scapula and clavicle make which kind of girdle? The pectoral girdle, and the ascoxae make the pelvic girdle, right? And so the ascoxae completely surround the pelvic cavity, and that's what a girdle does. A girdle just surrounds something. Okay. Well, here is an ascoxae, and then here is the deep depression, which we call the acetabulum, and this is what the head of the femur attaches to, right? So the head of the femur is the proximal part of the femur, and there's only one bone in the thigh, and that is the femur. So you notice that the acetabulum is much deeper than the glenoid fossa that we find on the scapula, so the hip joint is a lot stronger joint that can withstand a lot more force, but as a result, you lose some range of motion because of that. That's just what we call a trade-off. Okay, remember that the ascoxae is made up of 3 different bones that have fused during development. And that is the ilium. How would you describe the location of the ilium compared to the other two? Yeah, I like superior, right? That's a good way to think about it. And the pubis bone, or pubic bone. Where would we look for that. That's a nice anterior landmark. And then the ischium, where would we look for that? Posterior and inferior to, I would say probably both of those, right? Okay, so that's how you'll find your way around. And if you're looking at the acetabulum, that will also tell you one other important way that you're looking at the bone. Okay, is that going to be anterior, posterior, lateral, superior? Lateral, that's right, because here's where the head of the femur has to attach. Right, so we know this is a nice lateral view. All right, here's a pretty good quiz, and that is, what do we find between the greater sciatic notch and lesser sciatic notch? What do we have? Ah, but there's a lot of different kinds of spines on the ascoxae. And in particular, I want to know how many are there between the greater and lesser sciatic notches? There is only one. Yeah, there's only one. So that's kind of a trick question. You don't see that usually until later on when you study the ascoxae, but I think I would like for you to see that sooner rather than later. So here's the greater sciatic notch. Here's the lesser. That's going to be posterior, of course. And then here is that spine. And since the spine is on the ischium, we call that the ischial spine, as opposed to these up over here and up over here. These are the iliac spines, right? So there are four iliac spines, only one ischial spine. Okay, so attached to this bone right here is the femur, and you're going to see that it looks similar to the humerus, all right, but it's bigger and stronger because it has to hold up much more weight. Here is the head of the femur. This is the nice articulating surface. It's a condyle. It's smooth. It will be covered with hyaline cartilage. And then in the head of the femur, there's going to be a pit right here. That's called the fovea capitis. There's a ligament that's going to attach the head of the femur to the acetabulum. And I don't know if you have to know the name of that ligament, but I'll tell you, it's a ligamentum teres. Maybe you do have to know the name of that ligament. Nonetheless, it is important because following that ligament into the head of the femur right here is an important blood vessel, right? And what can you tell me about this bone? Is it living tissue or is it just like a piece of wood or cement or something? It's living tissue, right? So the reason why that blood vessel is going into the head of the femur is to bring nutrients and oxygen to all of these osteocytes in this part of the bone. When it gets damaged, then the proximal epiphysis of the femur, the head of the femur right here, just dies. And it necroses and it dissolves away. Instead of having a nice smooth surface, you might have just a jagged, ragged edge right here. And when you have degeneration of the head of the femur, what are you a good candidate for? Yeah, we would want a transplant, right, to get your hip back. So a good hip transplant, pretty common procedure these days. But I find that kind of interesting because I think of a very impressive athlete. And he played professional football and professional baseball in the same season. And I don't know if many of you guys are sports fans or not. And as a matter of fact, he got tackled one time and that blood vessel got damaged and the head of the femur dissolved away. The necrosis dissolved away and he needed a hip transplant. And he was such a phenomenal athlete, and this is the thing that really impresses me. He was such a phenomenal athlete that he even went back and played professional baseball with an artificial hip. Does anybody know who that was? That was Bo Jackson. Yeah, Bo Jackson. Amazing. Anyway, so maybe catch some clips on YouTube of Bo Jackson playing football and baseball. All right, so here's the head. This narrowing, of course, is what we call the neck. And on the humerus, like we have some tubercles, greater and lesser tubercle, we have similar kinds of processes on the femur, but they're much bigger, so we don't call them tubercles, we call them trochanters. Greater trochanter, lesser trochanter. There's some other things in this area that I don't think I'm going to have you know. Like this intertrochanteric line, right? That's a process for muscle attachment. And as a matter of fact, if you look at this greater trochanter here, you know that its function is for muscle attachment. And what would you guess? What kind of muscles attach to the greater trochanter? Could you describe something about the nature of those muscles? Strong, powerful muscles, right? Because it's a big, thick process. On the posterior side of the femur, we do have another process. We call that the linea aspera. And that's kind of an easy name to remember because it shows up just like a line. Right, and that's how it got its name. So then going all the way through the diaphysis to the distal epiphysis, we see some smooth articulating surfaces, both anteriorly and posteriorly. The posterior ones we're going to call condyles. And there's going to be a medial and lateral one. How are you going to find which one is medial on a femur? Look for the head of the femur. Hopefully it's there for you to see. And then on that same side, right, that's going to be the medial side because that's got to attach to the acetabulum, right? So here's the medial side. So here is the medial condyle, lateral condyle. There's a space between them. That's called intercondylar fossa. And there are epicondyles above both those condyles. And again, they're just labeled medial and lateral. So you got to know for sure which is medial and lateral. On the anterior side, right, we do have a nice condylar surface for the patella, which is your kneecap, right? So it articulates with the femur just in this location. So that's pretty much it for the femur. Now, do you see a surgical neck on the femur? What kind of neck do you see? A regular old neck, right? There's no surgical neck. There's no anatomic neck. The anatomic neck and surgical neck are the same location on the femur. All right, so this area of the bone is very strong. The neck is relatively weak compared to the head and the trochanters. All right, so that's it for the femur. And how many femurs do you have in your thigh? You have two? In a thigh, how many do you have? You have one, all right. Just like in your arm, you only have one humerus, right? Okay. All right, unlike in the forearm and the leg, there are two bones, right? And, of course, let's just review really quick for fun. In the forearm, can you name the bones? There's radius and ulna. Which one's lateral? You got to definitely practice that so it just comes through you really, really fast. Lateral one is the radius. Medial one is the ulna. Okay, remember when you take your pulse right over here along with your, just right above your thumb, we call that the radial pulse because the radial artery goes right through there. It goes, of course, right along the radius bone. Okay, so I see that was a little bit of a challenge, and to know the medial and lateral bones in the leg is a challenge as well, but it's something that you just have to be really familiar with. All right, so here are the two bones. You've got the tibia and fibula. Fibula is lateral. The fibula is going to take the place of the radius. And the tibia is going to be medial, the medial strong bone in your leg. And as a matter of fact, during a test or a practicum, you can palpate. You can go down below your knee and actually feel, right, this anterior crest or anterior border on the tibia. And you can even feel this big squamous region here on the tibia, and you're going to notice that's medial. And you have so many muscles around the fibula that you can't even feel it, right? And that's going to be lateral. So even with your fingertips, right, the push comes to shove, you should be able to tell which one is which. But hopefully you'll know a lot quicker than having to palpate your leg. All right, so the head of the tibia has some condylar surfaces, right? One is going to be the medial condyle, and one's going to be the lateral condyle, which is really important. Why? You got to know medial and lateral. And if we scoot all the way down to the distal epiphysis, here is a bone that's sticking out. Here's a process. That's your ankle bone. If you feel your ankle, there's a bone that's sticking out down there. This is what we call the medial malleolus. So again, I want you to know that the tibia is medial because this malleolus right here is the medial one. You also have a bump on your ankle on the other side, on the lateral side, and that's going to be the lateral malleolus. Now, what bone has the lateral malleolus on it? The fibula does, right? Okay, so in terms of medial and lateral malleolus, you have to know which bone is medial and lateral. And then also for these condylar surfaces, you just got to really get down with the medial and lateral. And in the next chapter, we're going to learn about some menisci and ligaments and things like that, and we're going to name them medial and lateral as well. Okay, I see a process right here, right? That's the tibial tuberosity, some really powerful anterior muscles in your thigh attached right here that allows you to do that kicking kind of motion. So here's the tibial tuberosity. The fibula doesn't have much in the way of
any structures that we're going to comment on. But the distal epiphysis, we're going to call the lateral malleolus, and the proximal is what we're going to call the head. And there are some articulating surfaces between the tibia and fibula, right, the tibulo-fibular joint. So here is the proximal, here's the distal one. And there is a ligament between the fibula and tibia, just like there is between the ulna and radius, but it does not really restrict motion very much. All right, but nonetheless, there is a connection between these two bones. All right, so that's bones of the leg, pretty much. Right between the medial and lateral condyles, I see something that looks like a point right here. We're going to call that the intercondylar eminence, and there are some very important ligaments that attach right between the condyles of the tibia. And we're going to see what those things are in the next chapter. Okay, so here I can see that intercondylar eminence right here. All right, so what malleolus is this right here on the tibia? Medial malleolus, right? Lateral malleolus is on the fibula. Okay, I think we've kind of looked at all that already. Okay, so that takes us to the counterpart to the hand, and that is the foot. And just like the hand has wrist, the foot has ankle bones. And it has bones that make up the foot, just like there are bones that make up the hand, and then there are bones that make up digits, just like in the hand. So let's look at some of these things. All right, the bones that make up the ankle are called tarsals. What are they called in the hand? Carpals, yeah. They're called carpals, but in the foot they're tarsals. And you can see that they're bigger, more massive, and of course they have to hold up a whole lot more weight than the ones in our wrist, so you would expect that. And in the wrist, I wanted you to know one carpal in particular. Which one was that? Yeah, the scaphoid, right below the radius, right? It's easily damaged. Well, in the ankle, I want you to know two. Right, and I want you to know the one that makes up the heel. So when you strike your foot on the ground, this is the bone that hits the ground. That's called the calcaneus. And the one just superior to it is called the talus. And the talus forms a joint with the tibia and fibula that makes your ankle joint. And that's pretty much just a hinge joint. And that talus fits right between the malleoli. Close your eyes a second. I want to flip around just a little bit to see if I can show you. I can't. I was going to show you how nice the talus fits between the tibia and fibula. Eventually, I'll find that slide. All right, so the rest of these bones, and there are eight of them, are just what we call tarsals, right? So you got to know talus and calcaneus, one because it's your hip, the other because it articulates with the tibia and fibula. Then you have bones of the foot proper, and they're named pretty much like your hand, starting with your great toe. You could think of this as like being your thumb if it was your hand. That's number one digit. And, of course, then you count out to five. Five is your little toe. And, of course, we're not going to call these metacarpals because those are, where do you find metacarpals? In your hand. These are what we call metatarsals. All right, so just, I don't know how you're going to remember that you start counting with your great toe. It's easy to mix up for some reason on some exams, right? So just start counting with the great toe. All right, and then we have some bones that make up the digits. Now, what do we call bones that make up the digits? They're phalanges. It's the same thing for the foot and the hand, right? And you see that for digit number one, there are only two, right? The proximal and distal, but all of the other digits have three, proximal, middle, and distal. And I tell you what, let me put my cursor right here. What bone am I pointing to right now? I would maybe start with a number. Number three. Middle. Phalange. Yeah, of the foot. And you on a report, you probably see a foot because if you just say phalanx, you might not know if it's a hand or a foot, right? Unless you have a nice picture of it. Okay. On the practicum, it's probably not so important that you do that. All right, well, everybody said it right. And I'm really glad. A lot of people have a tendency to say, name that bone right where I have the cursor as the number three, medial phalanx. But is it a medial phalanx? No, where is it? It's right in the middle. right? So middle and medial mean two separate different things. If you say medial phalanx, it really doesn't have much of any kind of meaning, right? You want to say middle for sure. All right, so that's pretty much it for the foot. And that's about all I'm going to say for this chapter, except I didn't mention this bone right here. Kind of a triangular-shaped bone. Here's the superior part. Here's the inferior part. The inferior part is the pointed end. A pointed end of something is what we call the apex. The pointed end of your heart is what we call the apex of the heart. So that's just some nomenclature that we're going to look at. The pointy end of the sacrum is the apex, right? So that's just some terminology that we use all the time. The anterior surface, you can see, is very rough. And this is for attachment of a ligament that goes to muscles in your thigh. We're going to see those to be the quadriceps. And then from the apex, there is a ligament that goes from that tibial tuberosity to the patella. Right? So sometimes we would call that the patellar ligament. And that other connection between the patella and the muscle, that's a tendon. Sometimes we call that the tendon of the quadriceps. All right, so this is where muscles attach. If we flip it over, we notice that the posterior side is, what does it look like, rough or smooth? It's going to be really smooth because it's going to articulate with what structure that you're aware of now? I talked about kind of fast. I don't know if you can remember seeing it or not. Okay, this articulating surface here is going to articulate with the, where is it? Right? The patellar surface on the anterior side of the femur. It's going to articulate right here. All right. So that is all the bones, right, of the appendicular skeleton. I might cover a couple little bit more details when we get into lab. Okay? Any questions on appendicular skeleton? It's nice that the upper and lower kind of mirror themselves, right? If you have a really good understanding of one, it's easy to get a pretty good understanding of the other. All right, so I'm going to put this away and then move on to joints. All right, so that's chapter 9. A joint and an articulation are exactly the same kind of thing. And we're going to classify joints, and remember, articulation or joint is just when two bones come together. And sometimes as we develop, as we grow older, that joint between bones actually ossifies so that a number of bones just become one. But let's think about young adulthood, adolescence, pre-adolescence, and actually consider where these bones touch each other to be joints that might have a particular function. All right, so how are we going to classify joints? Okay, classification of joints, we can classify them with a structural classification or a functional classification. Could be one or the other, and there's going to be some overlap in these things. But remember, a joint is an articulation. This is where sites of two or more bones meet, right? And some of these joints give the human skeleton mobility, and some joints are really tough and stiff. So these joints help hold the skeleton together. Right, in terms of the structural classification, this is just plain old anatomy. Right, we have fibrous joints. What kind of chemical might you want to find in a fibrous joint? Or what would you expect? What would you not be shocked to see? Yeah, like collagen. Yeah, collagen, because that's, what, a really strong fiber. A cartilaginous joint, that's pretty easy to tell. There's going to be cartilage in there. Right, and synovial is a special joint all by itself, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Okay, because associated with the synovial joint, you're going to have cartilage, you're going to have collagen and other kinds of things. Right, so that's a special kind of joint. We can also classify joints by their function. Let's take a look at some of these functions right here. And the function really focuses on the amount of motion that is allowed by that particular joint and still maintain the health of the joint without damaging the joint. And here you can see the three classifications. They are in order of mobility. Right, so there are synarthroses, amphiarthroses, and diarthroses. So the diarthroses are the most movable. We call these freely movable joints. The synarthroses, on the other hand, are immovable joints. Have you ever seen an immovable joint yet in lab? Like what, for instance? Yeah, for instance, a suture is a really good example. Okay, so here's a suture between the flap bones of the skull, and for all purposes, you could say that that is an immovable joint. Maybe some people can see a little bit of motion right there, but basically there's no motion between these. All right, so how are you going to remember immovable, slightly movable, and freely movable? All right, well, if you take this first letter from each of these three words and put them together, what do you get? A big smile on your face because it says sad, and now you know exactly how to order these things in terms of mobility, right? Synarthroses, amphiarthroses, diarthroses. All right, so that's how we classify joints. Let's look at some nice examples of these things. All right, so a fibrous joint. If we're going to talk about fibrous joints, are we going to talk about a structural or functional classification? Okay, yeah, a fiber is part of the structural classification of joints. And let's talk about some of these fibrous ones. All right, a suture is one because we have collagen fibers between these bony plates of the skull, so a suture is a fibrous joint. If we look at another one, like the proximal distal fibulotalo joint right here, it's almost like a suture. There's no motion that's allowed right here, but these ligaments are longer. That's really the distinction between the ligaments that we see in a suture. Right, so can you see that the space that spans these two flat bones in the skull is a lot shorter compared to the distance between the lateral malleolus, right, and the styloid process right here on the tibia? These are much longer. Right, so that's a syndesmosis. Syndesmosis is like a suture, but just a little bit longer. And it's a highly stabilizing kind of joint. Right, so provides stability, which means that you sacrifice range of motion or mobility with that particular kind of joint. Another kind of joint, right, I'm looking at either a mandible or maxilla right here. I see a tooth, and here's the root of the tooth. And the root of the tooth fits into a pocket in a bone. What do we call that pocket once again? Yeah, an alveolus. So here's the alveolus, and the root of the tooth is right in there. And here are some ligaments that attach the root of the tooth to the alveolar processes here and here. So I don't know if you've ever eaten anything and you thought maybe it was going to be something that was soft, but when you bit into it, there was like a rock or something in there, or a piece of bone, right? You're unsuspecting of that. And it bent this tooth a little bit, and you felt some pain in this area right here. That's because these periodontal ligaments got stretched out for just a split second. Okay, so here are the periodontal ligaments. This kind of joint, which is a peg in a socket, is what we call a gomphosis. All right, so suture, right, and a suture, a gomphosis, and the syndesmosis are what kind of joints? Let's look over here. They are types of fibrous joints, right? So this is what a structural classification of joints, because they have fibers. All right. Suture, syndesmosis, gomphosis. All right, so what would be next in terms of structural classification? It would be a cartilaginous type joint. So let's look at some cartilaginous type joints. Synchondrosis. All right, so would you be able to tell a synchondrosis would be a cartilaginous type of joint? Now, how would you know? Because what do you hear in that word? You hear chondro, right? So chondro means cartilage, synchondrosis. And so here our bones are united by hyaline cartilage. We've got some hyaline cartilage right here. And sometimes these joints are freely movable, sometimes they're immovable. Here is that epiphyseal plate. This is where a bone grows in length, and it is cartilage before puberty. And this is a growing region, it's a growth plate, and this area is made up of hyaline cartilage. And what can you tell me about hyaline cartilage in terms of strength, of all the different kinds of cartilages that you know? Does it have any fibers? No. All right, there is elastic, there's fibrocartilage. Both elastic and fibrocartilage are much stronger, so it's easy to damage these joints. And of course, cartilage is even weaker than bone. Right, so here's that epiphyseal plate made of hyaline cartilage, which is relatively weak, relatively easy to damage compared to other kinds of cartilage, and indeed the bone that you see on either side. So this growth plate can be easily damaged by compression and torsion, right, and compression and tension. So that's why we're interested in this growth plate right here. Joints between the ribs and the sternum would be another good example of hyaline cartilage, right, a synchondrosis. And you know the first, well, how many ribs have these attachments directly to the sternum? Anybody remember what true ribs have, that connection? Yes, the superior seven of them are true ribs. All right, so here is a synchondrosis. And then another kind is a symphysis. A symphysis is made out of a lot tougher kind of material compared to a synchondrosis because it is fibrocartilage. A place where we have fibrocartilage is in between our vertebrae, right? In between what parts of the vertebrae? Can you see? You see this on the illustration right here. You should be able to tell what that is. Between the vertebral bodies. Yeah, the vertebral bodies. Right, because these bodies are supporting our weight. And then here is that joint between vertebral bodies, and it has fibrocartilage. And on the ends, it has a little bit of hyaline cartilage as well. So it's a kind of a complicated structure. And then on the inside, the nucleus propulsus even has like a jelly-like material. But right, we should think of this as fibrocartilage because it's very, very tough. Another area where there's fibrocartilage is in the pubic symphysis. So the pubic symphysis joins what two bones together? We sort of just got done talking about that. Yeah, the pubic bones together. So this is what, a nice anterior side. And the symphysis is slightly movable to highly immovable, right? So what was a slightly movable joint called? That was a SAD. It was an A, what's A? Amphiarthrosis, okay, and it's more movable at certain times of your life than others. For instance, during parturition, the sacroiliac joint, right, is released and the pubic symphysis is released a little bit, and that increases the diameter of the pelvic outlet for childbirth. So that's a really good thing. And then after parturition, then the pubic symphysis comes back together, mostly. Not exactly the way it was, but mostly comes back together. Okay, so here are some examples of fibrous joints and cartilaginous joints. All right, which takes us to another kind of joint, which is what we call a diarthrosis. Right, so symphyarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, diarthrosis. And in terms of mobility, what can you tell me about a diarthrosis? That is the most movable of all of those joints. And as a matter of fact, we're going to call it a freely movable joint. Freely movable and diarthrosis are the same thing. And all synovial joints are diarthroses, which means that synovial joints are highly movable. So if you're moving some joint in your body, like I am right now talking, right, I'm using my jawbone right here, my TMJ, it's moving, right, all the joints in my shoulder, elbow, fingers, right, these are diarthroses because they are synovial joints. So we have a nice picture right here of an exam figure, and it shows almost everything that we could find in a synovial joint. So let's take a look at the synovial joint, and I'll tell you just one thing that it's missing, or give you another picture of some things it's missing. All right, but do you see the epiphyses of the two bones? All right, so here's the proximal bone. Let's just say this is the distal one right here. So here's the distal epiphysis. Here's the proximal epiphysis. Now, do these bones touch each other? No, okay. What is protecting the ends of these bones? Cartilage, yeah, and you should know exactly what kind of cartilage is that. Okay, that is hyaline cartilage. Hyaline cartilage and articular cartilage are exactly the same thing, right? When somebody says articular cartilage, that's going to be hyaline cartilage. And here you can see covering the epiphyses of these two bones. And there's also something else. There's a space between the bones filled with synovial fluid. So that's another reason why the bones really don't touch each other. But when they're compressed, they can. And the cartilage protects the tips of these bones from wearing each other out. All right, so here is a cavity. All synovial joints have a cavity that's filled with synovial fluid. And that synovial fluid brings in some nutrients to keep those chondrocytes alive. Right, but that synovial fluid doesn't have enough nutrients and oxygen to help repair this cartilage, articular cartilage, if it gets damaged. Right? So there's really no way for this articular cartilage to repair itself. If you need to have articular cartilage placed between a couple bones, then you need a transplant, for instance, to do that, because it just won't grow back. All right, so here we see the synovial cavity filled with synovial fluid that helps nourish and lubricate the hyaline cartilage on the epiphyses of these bones. And the synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane, which is the deepest lining, right, that forms the joint capsule or articular capsule. Right, synovial membrane is producing synovial fluid. Sometimes we just say it's just a weeping production of synovial fluid. It just kind of weeps into the space. It's not a very high flow of material. Then on the outside of the synovial membrane, there is the fibrous capsule made of collagen, which is protecting the synovial joint, right, and the synovial membrane. And if we put the synovial membrane together with the fibrous capsule, we get something that's called the articular capsule. So all of the synovial joints have all of these features to them, which gives them a high degree of mobility. Well, there's something else that stabilizes the joint. There are two things that maybe stabilize a joint, and that is the shape of the joint, which we haven't really talked about very much yet, right? But it is also stabilized because there are ligaments that go across the joint on the outside of the articular capsule. Right, so here is just a ligament stabilizing this joint. And what's not shown on this slide, besides the shape of the joint, is that they could also be tendons that move across a joint. Right, so here I see a bone-to-bone connection. What do you call a bone-to-bone connection? A ligament. Okay, but a tendon is probably even more important for stabilizing a joint because on one end it's attached to a muscle. So just like this cartilage, if it's damaged, it doesn't regenerate. If this ligament is damaged, it has a lot of difficulty regenerating as well because it is basically avascular. There are no blood vessels, right, in dense, regular connective tissue. Once it's stretched out, it will stay stretched out. And that's why muscles are so important for maintaining the health or even rejuvenating a joint, because maybe the tendon got stretched out or damaged, and that will destabilize the joint. But what's on the other end of that tendon? A muscle. Yeah, it's a muscle. So that muscle can shorten. It can get stronger. Right? So even though that tendon was damaged, the muscle can get shorter and can then put the proper amount of tension on that tendon, which then stabilizes the joint. So if you need to rehabilitate a joint, probably one of the most important things you can do is rehabilitate the muscles or exercise the muscles that work across that joint. That's what will really stabilize the joint the most. Okay, as long as there's no damage, right? Serious damage inside the joint. All right, so what are the things that we have for a synovial joint? Articular cartilage, the joint cavity, the articular capsule. All right, articular capsule is made out of the fibrous, right, and synovial membrane put together, right, and then the synovial membrane secretes synovial fluid, right, the synovial membrane secretes synovial fluid. What am I missing on this slide right here? Okay, some other things. Maybe number four. What do we want to put in for number four? What did I leave out? Articular cartilage. Do I have the fibrous capsule? I have joint capsule. I don't have fibrous capsule. Maybe you should put fibrous capsule, right? So fibrous capsule plus synovial membrane make up the articular capsule. Those are the components. All right, we talked about some reinforcing ligaments. I see that on this slide. And nerves and blood vessels are not on this slide. Okay, well, we know the cartilage and dense regular connective tissue doesn't have much in the way of blood vessels. Some things that I haven't talked about yet are bursa, a tendon sheath, okay, and an articular disc. All right, so let's maybe look for some of these things. It's a nice exam figure right here. Moving through. Okay, I'll get to articular disc in just a second. So here I see the scapula. For instance, the acromion process on the scapula. Here's the head of the humerus. Right, head of the humerus is going to articulate in particular with the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa on the scapula. And that's not a very deep fossa, so that gives your shoulder joint a lot of mobility, a lot of dexterity. But nonetheless, this is a nice synovial joint. So what would we expect to see in a synovial joint? Okay, synovial fluid. I see it right here. I see some nice synovial fluid. Okay, and where's that coming from? That's coming from the synovial membrane. Here I see some synovial membrane right here. Okay, and then what is outside the synovial membrane? We have the fibrous capsule. Okay, and that just makes the articular capsule all put together. Right, and then here is that synovial fluid. And on the ends of bones, what do I see on the tips of these bones right here? Nice hyaline cartilage. And hyaline cartilage right here. Okay. Look at this little thing right here. Okay, it looks like a little lip. It's some fibrocartilage. Oh, and I see some right up over here as well. And that is some cartilage, not as strong as bone, but it helps increase the depth of the glenoid fossa. All right, so that helps stabilize the joint. Oh, I just remember what it's called. It's called the labrum, glenoid labrum. That's really important for athletes. That should never be damaged. Damage, for instance, if you're a pitcher, then that's pretty much the end of that pitcher's career, right? Because it really doesn't regenerate as a result of that, right? Glenoid labrum. I think there's a really good, nice picture in your book that labels this glenoid labrum right here. All right, so here is the head of the humerus, and then right above it is the acromion process, right? And the head of the humerus is doing all kinds of motions. It's rotating, flexing and extending, and it would rub up against the acromion process, but there is a special little, almost like a joint capsule between the humerus and the acromion process, and it's called a bursa. So a bursa has a synovial membrane, and it has a fibrous capsule, and it has synovial fluid on the inside, but it looks more like a pillow. And indeed it is. It's a special structure like a pillow between two bones that move against each other. And this particular bursa can even roll depending on the motion of the humerus. Right? So here is that bursa. It's underneath the acromion, so we call that the subacromial bursa. And so it just prevents friction, right, and inflammation in the shoulder joint. But just like everything in your body, if you use your shoulder inappropriately or you ask a lot of your shoulder day after day after day, maybe twist your shoulder, then there can be inflammation to this bursa, right? And it could be very, very painful and can inhibit the motion of the shoulder joint. And so what do we call an inflammation of a bursa? Bursitis. That's right. Exactly right. So this bursa right here will enlarge, it will swell up and become very, very painful. Right, so even though its job was to reduce friction, when it becomes inflamed, it actually increases friction between these two bones. And when that friction is increased, what happens to inflammation? Inflammation increases. And when inflammation increases, what happens to friction? Increases. So here you can see these terrible things kind of building upon each other, and sometimes it's very difficult to break that cycle that happens, right, the inflammatory cycle. Right, so that's so bursa we see between two bones. Well, there can be tendons that move and have a lot of force applied to them, and it might move across the surface of a bone or between surfaces in a bone, and that's what we're going to look at next. Right, and I want you to use the bursa as a model to understand something about a tendon sheath. So here is a tendon from the biceps. Can you point out where your biceps is? Just kind of for fun, your biceps is right here, right? And then there's a nice tendon, big long tendon that goes up all the way through and over the anterior part of your humerus, and it goes actually through the intertubercular groove, right? Inserts into a little tubercle above the glenoid fossa. So anytime you use your biceps, there's a lot of tension that's produced in that intertubercular groove. Right, and that tension could cause inflammation, which then would cause swelling, would cause more inflammation, right, and I could go on and on and on. So here is something like a bursa that wraps itself around that tendon of the biceps, right, and guess what that tendon sheath has? A fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, synovial fluid, and that just allows this tendon right here to be moving. Oh, here it is inserting into the a little tubercle above the glenoid fossa, right? And then that prevents inflammation of the shoulder joint. Right? So a tendon sheath is very much like a bursa, except it surrounds a tendon instead of filling a space between two bones. So that's a tendon sheath. Almost the same thing as a bursa. Ah, I do have it here. Number 11. I thought I didn't have it. The last thing that some synovial joints have is an articular disc. Sometimes we call that a meniscus. Has anybody ever heard of a meniscus before, where we might start to look for a meniscus? And a knee, that's right, a knee has menisci. Every knee has two of them. So let me see if I can find a meniscus. The shoulder doesn't have a meniscus. All right, we're going to look at some of these in a little bit. Let's look at some real joints. Ah, here is. All right, so here is a joint between the clavicle and the sternum. In particular, what part of the sternum? The manubrium, right? So we call this the sternoclavicular joint. And, of course, you see a nice joint capsule. And this is a synovial joint. It's a freely movable joint. And in this joint, there is an articular disc, right, that helps protect the ends of these bones. And it also helps stabilize the joint. So it helps match up the ends of these two bones. Okay, oh, here is that articular disc. Well, there is another location in the TMJ. What the heck is that TMJ once again? Temporomandibular joint. All right, so here is the temporomandibular joint. And you can see the fibrous capsule. You can see some synovial membranes. And then going right through the center of that joint is an articular disc. And that's going to remind you of a knee that we're going to look at in just a second. All right, so that temporomandibular joint is a pretty complicated joint. And I'm going to tell you what it does, but we haven't discussed what these different terms mean yet. It can elevate and depress, okay? And it can protract and retract. So elevate just means close your mouth, depress, open your mouth. Protract means you can jut your jaw forward. Be careful, don't chip a tooth. Or you can move your jaw back into your head. That's retraction. Okay, and then, of course, you can move from side to side, a grinding motion. So that's a pretty complicated joint. Can't do that with any of these joints in your finger, right? You'd break your finger if that were to happen. So something that helps stabilize this joint is the articular disc in a TMJ. Oh, here is, where was this? Ah. All right, so here is a pretty nice illustration of that fibrous material that we call the glenoid labrum, right, that makes the glenoid fossa a little bit deeper, but it's not as strong as bone, right, so it's easily damaged. All right, well, let's move on to another exam figure, and let's just start right here. All right, so can anybody recognize what kind of beast this is right here? Yeah, it's a knee, right? So we see some bones that you just learned about today, namely up over here, this is the what is up over here, and it goes way up over here. This is the femur, okay? And then here's that bone. It's a special kind of funny bone. We call it a sesamoid bone because it's embedded completely within a tendon. That is the patella, right? And that's why this surface is really rough, because you can see all these tendons and the ligaments attached to it. And so we call this the tendon of the quadriceps, because here I see three parts of the quadriceps muscle. There are actually four, but we can't see the fourth part. And there's a common insertion or attachment point to the patella. And then off the apex of the patella, there is a connection to the tibial tuberosity. So what do we call a bone-to-bone connection? A ligament, right? So this is what we call the patellar ligament. The one above, up over here, is a tendon, because it's a muscle-to-bone connection, right? Even though this patella is right smack in the middle of everything, we still call this the ligament and this the tendon. All right, well, I see some other bone-to-bone connections. So which ones do I want you to know? I want you to know this one here and this one over here, and not some of these others. All right, so here is the tibia, here's the fibula, and the tibia, is that the medial or lateral bone in your leg? Or is it your foreleg? Is it foreleg or leg? It's just plain old leg, right? Forearm and arm, but in your lower appendage, it's just your leg. All right, so the tibia is medial. So here is the medial collateral ligament, or you could call it the tibial collateral ligament. So either one would work just fine. During a lab practicum, so if you forget what's medial or lateral, but you see it attached to the tibia right here, you could call it the tibial collateral ligament. But in real life, people talk about it almost in the same sentence using both those terms, so you should really know that this tibia is medial. And then, okay, from the femur down to the head of the fibula, right, we got the fibular collateral ligament. So these both span the joint, one medial and one laterally. Maybe I get to talk about what some of these ligaments do in just a little bit. All right, so this is on the outside. Can you picture the fibula, tibia, ligament, patellar ligament, patella, tendon of the quadriceps, and the two collateral ligaments? You can't see the femur right here. We would maybe want to see the patellar surface of the femur and the articulating surfaces of the patella, but we would have to, right, make a cut right here and then reflect that tissue down, open it up kind of like a book to see what's deep inside the knee. Okay, so let's do that. So that's exactly what we did right here. All right, so I still see the fibula and tibia. Here's the tibial tuberosity. So here is the patellar ligament. Remember, ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. Here is the articulating surface of the patella. Right, here's the patellar surface on the femur. And then here is a condyle on the femur. What condyle is this? What condyle is this? You can't see the head of the femur, so you can't use that as a reference. The only thing, way that you could tell is by knowing which bones in the leg are medial, or which one is medial, which one is lateral. So I wanted to know this one here that matches up with the fibula, so that is the lateral condyle, which means this is the medial condyle. All right, and again, I can see the collateral ligaments. So here's the lateral collateral ligament. Here is the medial collateral ligament. And now I can see some of the articular discs inside the knee. All right, and so we call this a meniscus. It's fibrocartilage, and it should remind you of a letter of the alphabet. What letter does this remind you of? What does it remind you of? Did I hear a Z? Did I hear a Z? No, a C. I hear a C. Who thinks it's a C? I like a C too. It looks like a C to me, especially this one over here. So we call these C-shaped cartilages. There are two, and they just help arrange the surface of these two bones, so that helps stabilize the joint. Right? Even though it's fibrocartilage, it is still cartilage, which means how strong is it compared to bone? It's still weaker than bone. It's about as strong a cartilage as you can get, but it's still weaker than bone. So it can be damaged, right? If a knee is used inappropriately, it can rip and it can tear. And notice that the ends, the tips of the
menisci, like right here, become very thin. And as you go laterally or if you go medially, the meniscus gets thicker and thicker and thicker. All right, so the thick regions, the menisci hardly ever get damaged, but the thin regions is where we typically see a lot of rips and tears, and maybe this thing can even just rip right off, right? And then it's going to be thin on one end and thick on the other, and it's going to look like a doorstop that you put underneath the door. It's going to look like a wedge. And indeed, this little broken piece of the meniscus can act like a wedge and even lock somebody's knee into a certain position. Right? And these menisci don't heal themselves either. And so sometimes you have to have some surgery to remove those parts of the broken meniscus or maybe surgically remove some parts that are torn. And in the old days, if there was damage to a meniscus, the whole meniscus was removed. Now, what do you think about that, removing the whole meniscus? Well, you might think of, well, why is it there to begin with? Okay, if you take it out, then you're defeating the purpose of why it was there in the beginning, so maybe it's not such a good idea to remove, right, that whole meniscus. And indeed, if it's removed, then the hyaline cartilage, right, on the femur touches the hyaline cartilage on the tibia. Remember, all your weight is on that knee, and that caused a premature arthritis in people that had a total meniscus removal. So now, surgeons try to preserve as much meniscus as possible and just remove part of the meniscus that is torn or can't be repaired. Right, so it's a nice C-shaped fibrocartilage. And you see one is medial and one is lateral. And how are you going to know which one is the medial one? Because it matches up with the tibia. And the lateral one is going to match up with the fibula. Okay, so that's how you know these right here. So again, really important to know medial and lateral bones of the leg. All right, I see the collateral ligaments, very nice. But I see two more ligaments. And these cross over each other. They form an X. All right, and hence, these are called the cruciate ligaments because they cross over each other. The one that in the front, that's the anterior cruciate ligament, and the one that is in the back is the posterior cruciate ligament. Probably anybody that's involved with sports at all have heard of these different ligaments. And, of course, it's what? A bone-to-bone connection. And they both insert into that intercondylar eminence, right, in between the condyles of the tibia. All right, so what do these things do? What do these ligaments do? Maybe I have a couple pictures in here. Where do I have a picture? Oh, I can see the cruciate ligaments very nice now. Okay, and you can see this anterior cruciate ligament is putting some tension on the tibia so that the tibia doesn't move out from underneath the femur. It doesn't move anteriorly. Right, that's its job. This posterior cruciate ligament will prevent, right, the posterior movement of the tibia with respect to the femur. But if somebody gets hit in the leg and very forcefully moves the tibia anterior like that, right, then it's very common to have a rip of the anterior cruciate ligament. Right, or if somebody's hit from the front, a football player hit from the front, and their leg is pushed backwards while the rest of their body stays in position, then the posterior cruciate ligament is going to rip and tear as a result of that. All right, so that's the job of these cruciate ligaments, to keep the tibia right underneath the femur where it belongs. That's its job. So it can't move anteriorly, can't move posteriorly. If it moves anteriorly, we call that protraction, like when you jut your mandible forward, protraction. So the anterior cruciate ligament prevents protraction. The posterior cruciate ligament prevents retraction of the knee, because the knee should really be just a nice hinge joint. Okay, I don't think I have a picture of it. All right, but here I see nice powerful muscle, the quadriceps. And here is that tendon of the quadriceps. When these quadriceps contract, it really bangs, right? Just pounds up against the femur right here. What kind of structure are you aware of that can protect this femur and protect this ligament from that pounding that's going on? Thank you so much. I'm going to put the sign-in sheet up here on the
front table so he can sign it when you walk out of class, okay? Okay. We just sort of got done talking about it. What kind of pillow can be placed or is placed or develops in these areas to prevent inflammation of those two structures? A bursa, that's right. So typically you would see a bursa here, right? The suprapatellar bursa, infrapatellar bursa right over here. And I'm sure there's some, there's talks about some injury that we mentioned already. Okay. So that's the knee. Knee is an exam figure. These, those two figures that I showed you, which were this one right here, right, and this one right here. What's nice about the knee is that it just forms a nice matrix. It's easy to appreciate these things, right? We got things on the side, things in the middle, and it's very easy for most students to understand this particular drawing, especially in lab when we have really nice models of the knee. Okay, let's talk about some motion in synovial joints. So these are motions in a freely movable joint. There are some motions that we call a gliding motion. Oh, close your eyes. I'm just going to flip through a bunch of these. Oh, look at that nice knee replacement happening right there. A gliding motion. I guess I don't have much of a gliding motion. Okay. Gliding motion between the bones of the wrist. All right, so these surfaces between the carpals are kind of flat, and they can kind of just slide over the surface of each other. All right, so moving your hand back and forth like this, medial and laterally, that is due to a gliding motion of carpals. Then we have a whole bunch of motions that are angular movements. All right, so let's see if I can find a nice angular movement. Nice angular movement. Okay, here's a good one. Good angular movement. Oh, but it's got a fancy name. Okay. I do want to start right here. Okay, but I'm going to give you an example first. You don't have this in your textbook, so I'll turn a light on for a second. Okay. So I just raised my arm up, right? And so here's my elbow joint, right? And here's my arm, here's my forearm. And my elbow is a freely movable joint, so I can move my forearm so it gets closer, comes up to my arm. All right, so when I'm in a relaxed position, can you see that my elbow joint is making 180 degree bend? It's just flat, right? And when I contract my biceps, what happens to that angle? It decreases, right? So here it's 90, less than 90. Okay, whenever we decrease the angle between two parts of your body or two bones, we call that flexion, right? Flexion is decreasing the angle. That's antagonistic to another motion that we call extension. So how would you define extension? Increasing the angle between two bones. Right, and so don't forget, your phalanges are long bones. So if you go like this with your phalanges, what kind of motion would that be? Like grabbing something. That would be flexion, and then straightening it back out would be extension. Right. Okay. Well, you can kind of do the same thing with your vertebral column. All right, so you have to use your mind just a little bit to imagine what's going on. Right, but if you're bending forward like this, we call that flexion, okay? And so we have a bunch of flexor muscles in our anterior part of the body. If you stand straight up again, we call that extension. And furthermore, you can turn your head all the way back like that. That's what we call hyperextension, right? So you got flexion, extension, hyperextension. There really is no such thing as hyperflexion. All right. Now, what about your elbow? We got flexion, extension. What about hyperextension? No, something's going to break. So not all of these motions are allowed. All depends on the surface of the joints that are involved with that. Okay, so flexion and extension are antagonistic motions. So you're going to have two sets of muscles that control whether a joint is flexing or extending. And Of course, you want to be able to flex and extend at a joint so that you have precise control of your body, just like you have a brake and a gas pedal in your car, so you have precise control and balance of your car, right? So you need both of those to know exactly where some part of your body is going. All right, so flexion and extension here is of the spine, in particular the cervical spine. Here it is, right, with the lumbar flexion, extension, and even hyperextension once again. Okay, what about the knee? Oh, the knee is a good place to start. I should have started with that one. All right, so I'm standing straight up like this, and maybe some of you can see I'll stand over here. So what motion is this? I'm decreasing the angle between my femur and my tibia. That is flexion, and then here is extension. What about hyperextension? No, you don't want to hyperextend, right? So flexion, extension. Now, what about my hip? Okay, and so don't pay attention to my leg. Just think about my thigh right here, because I want you to just look at my hip. What's happening to my hip? Okay, that's flexion, right? Because here is 180 degrees, and now 90, 0. Yeah, okay, so flexion, and then here is extension, and what about that? Hyperextension, yeah. So you can flex, you can extend, hyperextend at the hip, because it's a special kind of joint that allows for that kind of motion. All right, so you see flexion and extension on this chart right here. I don't see the hip motion anywhere. Maybe there's a hip, but that's an important one. So here we have the hip, right? And if you're going to think about another joint in your body that's similar to a hip, what other joint would that be? Your shoulder, okay. Well, you can do a lot of things with your shoulder, including flex and extend. But how are you going to know what is flexion and extension with a shoulder joint? I could never use the general rules, right? So if you decrease an angle, that's flexion, increase, that's extension. Well, how do you flex and extend the shoulder? I don't really see the angles that are involved with that, right? So here is flexion of the shoulder. Here is extension. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Here is hyperextension. All right, so how are you going to remember that? Because just think of your hip. What's this? Flexion, what's that? Extension, what's that? Hyperextension. So just think of your hip in terms of what your shoulders. Can you appreciate sort of what was going on? Flexion, extension, right? Hyperextension. So just kind of mimic what's going on in your hip, and you'll understand what the shoulder is doing. Oh, here it is right here. Yeah. Okay, flexion moving forward, extension moving backwards. So that's kind of a funny motion to see. Okay, another kind of angular motion. Angular motion. Actually, I want to talk about where's abduction? Oh, here. Abduction and adduction. What the heck is this thing right here? Okay, if we bring bones together, like all of our digits right here have bones. If we bring all of our fingers together, we're adding our fingers together, right? So we bring our fingers together, we call that adduction. If we separate our fingers, that is abduction. You can do that with your arms. So if you bring your arms down to your side, that is adduction. If you move your arms up like that, that is abduction. All right, so these muscles up over here, the deltoid, are abductors to help elevate your arms like so. Okay, and so the same thing with your legs, right? Abduction, adduction. And so we got very powerful adductors in our thigh that bring our legs together. Otherwise, our legs would fall apart and we'd fall right through our legs, right, onto the floor. So we got really important, strong adductor muscles that bring our ankles together. Okay. The other thing you can do with your shoulder is you can rotate. And a good way to picture what rotation of the shoulder is first bend your elbow like this, right? And I want you to just focus on what's happening to, what bone is this right here? That is the humerus, okay? And rotation is just what, like a twisting. And so I'm rotating my shoulder right now, but it's kind of hard to visualize. So if you bend the elbow, okay, and I've rotated my humerus so that my hand is moving medially. Now it's moving laterally. There's nothing down here that's moving. What's moving? Only the humerus, right? So here's a lateral rotation, here's a medial rotation. Lateral, medial rotation. And those are important motions. Has anybody ever heard of a rotator cuff injury? Rotator cuff? Okay, raise your hand. Okay, that's good. That's great. If you've heard of rotator cuff injury and you can still raise your hand, that's wonderful, because that's one of the motions that could be really difficult. One way to kind of quickly diagnose rotator cuff injury is to see if you can perform a lateral rotation. So how would you do that? Bend at the elbow. Lateral rotation would be out to the side. So have somebody medial rotate, rotator cuff doesn't have any problem with that. Now apply a little force like that, and can they push against that hand that you're restricting the motion of the shoulder? And when they push, if it's a recent injury, they'll probably scream in pain because it really hurts. Okay, so rotator cuff, no lateral rotation. We'll look at some muscles involved with that. Okay, so we got, what can we do with the shoulder? Ooh, what's this? Let's try this out. What's that? And what's this? And what's that? Yeah, you guys are good. Okay, what is this? Okay, abduction, what's this? Adduction, okay, what's that? Rotation, medial rotation, lateral rotation. Well, your shoulder can do all of those things at one time, right? And it's this kind of motion. Right? So we're abducting, we're flexing, adducting, and rotating, doing all kinds of things like that. That's what we call circumduction. So you can circumduct with your hip, you can circumduct with your shoulder, and only those two joints, because they have a special structure that allows for that to happen. It's called a ball and socket joint. Okay? Okay, let's talk about a couple other kinds of motion. In anatomic position, which way are your thumbs pointing? Laterally. Okay. It's not a very relaxed position. I'm relaxed now, but to get my thumbs pointing laterally, I have to contract some muscles. Okay. And that is anatomic position. We say that our hands are supinated. Right? If our palms are facing posterior like that, we say that is pronated. Supination and pronation are antagonistic motions. So how do I remember? Well, if we go into a supinated position, right, and we bring our hands together, what do we have right here? Don't tell anybody I told you this. This is a sup bowl. Alright, so this is supination. Alright, and so if we go from the supinated position to facing our palms posteriorly, that is pronation, right? So here is supination, pronation. Or you could say palms facing posteriorly is pronation. Palms facing anteriorly is supination. So that's kind of a strange one. Okay, elevation and depression. Talked about that already in terms of the mandible. When you close your mouth, that's elevation. When you open your mouth, that's depression. You can do the same thing with your shoulders. Right here is elevation. Here is depression. You can also move your shoulders anteriorly, like so. That is protraction. You can move your shoulders back like that. That is retraction. Again, you can do that with the mandible. You can protract and retract the mandible. All right, so those are some kind of interesting ones. Opposition can occur at one joint. All right, what digit is this right here? Yeah, which way am I pointing? I'm trying to figure this one. This is number one, right? Number one has a special joint that allows you to move the thumb anterior to your hand. That's what we call opposition, that allows you to grasp things, right? So opposition is an important motion. Okay, inversion, eversion of the ankle. A lot of people can strain their ankle by inversion. Question? No, you're good. Okay. You can sprain your ankle by inversion, and that's when you twist your ankle so that you're trying to stand on your lateral malleolus, the malleolus of your fibula. Okay, like so. Maybe some people in the front row can see what I'm doing. Okay, and it's really easy to invert your foot like that. You don't have a lot of ligaments that prevent that kind of motion. Inversion, like that. If you go the other way, try to stand on your medial malleolus, that's really tough to do because you have a lot more stabilizing ligaments across the ankle in that direction. All right, so it's easy to invert when you sprain an ankle, really difficult to evert. But if you do have an eversion injury,
you think that's worse or not as bad as an inversion injury? It's going to be worse, right, because you have a lot more ligaments making it a strong joint, and if all those fail, it's a much worse ankle kind of injury. So inversion, eversion. Okay, and then the next one. Are we done at 12:05? We're done at 12, so I guess we're done. But the next one is really important. You want to follow this one for sure on your grandma and grandpa. It's called plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. Because we can use it to maybe diagnose spinal cord injuries. So we got to finish talking about that one on Wednesday. Here's the sign-in sheet.